Well, I invite you to turn again this morning to the letter of Paul to the Galatians, and we're in chapter 6. We are coming close to the end of our studies in Galatians. We have been looking at this epistle for some time now, and I personally would be gladly extending our studies. This is one of the greatest of the New Testament epistles, probably second only to the letter to the Romans. And in this letter, as we have seen over these past months, the apostle is describing authentic Christianity. This is quite possibly the first letter that Paul wrote. If it is not the first, it is certainly one of his earlier letters. It's not one of the ones that came later on towards the end of his life. And if, in fact, it is the first or perhaps the second of his epistles, what we have here is really primitive Christianity. This is a summary epistle where Paul is writing in the emergency, as it were, that he has heard about in the churches at Galatia. And Paul is not writing with a calm, dispassionate, cool method of simply sitting down in a comfort zone and writing a letter of good advice to some religious people. He is writing out of a deep feeling of concern, verging almost on anxiety. Paul tells them, he says, I am concerned about you. I'm really troubled about you, Galatians, because you're turning away from him who called you, and you're turning into another gospel, a gospel that is no gospel, but a gospel that nonetheless seems to be like the gospel because it's using the language of the gospel, but it's emphasizing some things that are far removed from the authentic gospel. And we've been studying through these months and a considerable number of months now Paul's argument from the very beginning. Who is it we're to believe? How are we going to be saved? And how are we going to live the Christian life? Is it going to be liberty or is it going to be bondage? Are we going to live according to God's will or man's will? It's one or the other. There's no neutrality. There is no possibility of exemption. We're all involved in this. And we all make up our minds and set our life according as we think of what the gospel is. Well, we're in chapter 6. We've spent a couple of Sunday mornings looking at the opening five verses. And last Sunday morning, you may remember, we were in verses 6 to 10. Where Paul was giving to us a general principle that we find right throughout the Bible, almost so obvious as to hardly be worth mentioning, but we do mention it, and that is that there is a relationship between sowing and reaping. Every one of us is going to reap in this world and in eternity according as we have sowed. We either sow to the flesh or we sow to the Spirit. There's no third alternative. It's one or the other. And Paul gave two examples of what he is meaning by sowing to the flesh or the spirit. First of all, you remember the area of sharing in verse number 6. Let him that is taught in the word communicate in fellowship giving with him who teaches. We saw the reciprocity that there was between those who are taught and those who teach. Those who are taught should give something to the teacher, and those who teach should be very clear that they give the proper teaching to those whom they are teaching. And the final example, or the second example, is in verses 8 to 10. Let us not be weary in well-doing, verses 9 and 10. The practical command to love, doing good to all men, especially to those who are of the household of the faith. Now, in verse 10, the apostle, in a sense, comes to the end of the teaching substance of the epistle. And what we have from verse 11 to the end of this epistle is Paul concluding. This is the conclusion. But what Paul is doing as he concludes this epistle is exactly the same as he does in practically all of his epistles. He goes over, he summarizes in a few words what he has been driving at. In the opening verses of the letter, Paul has been telling these Galatians, what he's going to be writing about. And then he is writing about it in the main body of the epistle. And from verse 11, he is really reminding them of some things that he's already said. He's not introducing any new doctrine. And so Paul, as he comes to conclude the epistle to the Galatians, is doing what he does, for example, in the epistle to the Romans. You remember when we were studying the latter chapters in Romans quite some time ago now, we came to chapter 16 in Romans, and we saw that it was really, on the face of it, nothing more than a list of names. 20-odd names are being mentioned. And there are those who say that Paul is really winding down his epistle, and that the removal of chapter 16 from the epistle to the Romans wouldn't make any difference really to the teaching. And I argued on that occasion when we were looking at that chapter, you may remember, I made the point that Paul is not winding down his great epistle to the Romans. He is actually winding it up, because all these names that are mentioned, they're all Christians. And ultimately, all that Paul has been saying in the previous 15 chapters in Romans is leading to the point that there are such people as Christians. There is such a thing as the church, and there is the fellowship of God's people. And the purpose of the gospel ultimately is not that we might know a doctrine, but that we might know God, and that we might become Christians in fellowship one with the other. And so what Paul is doing in Romans chapter 16 is in fact not closing down, but closing up. He is winding up on a climax. This is the result of what Christ has done. This is the result of God's purposes of grace, working all things together for good to those who love God. What is the purpose of it all? It is that we might be believers, that we might be in harmony together with every other believer. And that is why in Romans chapter 16, Paul sends all these greetings to the church at Rome, and other people join in sending the greetings. So Romans doesn't conclude, as it were, on a down note. He doesn't wind it all down by drawing together some secondary issues. He is pointing up to the main point of the gospel, and that is the salvation of God's people. Now, Paul is doing exactly the same kind of thing here in the conclusion to Galatians. These final verses, 11 to 18, are not some kind of come down from the great teachings that he's been emphasizing in the previous chapters. They are bringing it all together in a kind of a climax, with a kind of a flourish. And the Apostle Paul is ending on a high note, as he does always. And we have it in 2 Timothy, for example, Paul's swan song, the last letter that Paul ever wrote. And it's not a matter of winding down. He is speaking of his imminent death. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. 2 Timothy chapter 4 is a high point, not a low point, in the writing of the Apostle Paul. And so when we come to these closing verses in Galatians, and we're going to begin to study them this morning, we are to see these verses not as Paul, just as it were, withering down, but rather reaching to the point. He has been heading for this all the time. This is what he has been writing about. Everything has been with a view. It has been a means to an end, as it were, of what he is actually saying in these closing verses in Galatians. This is the point of the epistle from beginning to end. And we're going to be looking at this over the next couple of weeks or so. Well, we're going to concentrate our thinking this morning on verses 11 to 13 in Galatians chapter 6, at verse 11 to 13. You see how large a letter I have written unto you with my own hand. As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they constrain you to be circumcised, only lest they should suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. For neither they themselves who are circumcised keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised, that they may glory in your flesh. Now you recognize immediately in these verses that Paul is returning to certain themes that he has been emphasizing throughout the epistle. And the themes are basically this: what is authentic Christianity? What is the gospel? What is Christianity in reality? Is it something that comes from man? Is it something that we do? Or is it something that comes from God? Is it divine in its origin, or is it human? Is it divine in its ultimate purpose? Does it terminate in man, or does it terminate in God? Is it something that is internal and spiritual, or is it something that is external and physical? And that is what Paul is really dealing with in these verses. As many as desire to make a vain show in the flesh, for neither they themselves who are circumcised keep the law, and so on. So we're going to be looking at the two main issues that Paul is dealing with. What is the gospel? What is the significance of the cross of Christ in the gospel? What is the significance of human circumcision in terms of the gospel? Or what is the significance of baptism or any other human ritualistic thing in terms of the gospel? So we're going to be looking at these issues. But before we do so, we must look at verse number 11. Now, verse number 11 in Galatians chapter 6 reads, "You see how large a letter I have written unto you with my own hand." And the scholars differ, as you can imagine, as to what is it Paul is talking about. Why does he mention this, and what does he mean when he says, "You see, you notice, or take notice of how large a letter or how large writing I have already written unto you." And the scholars differ quite markedly in their interpretation of Paul's large letter. And there are various views, as you can understand. There are those who take the view that the Apostle Paul, as he does from time to time, we have reason to believe, that the Apostle Paul did not personally write, that is, taking pen in hand and actually writing his own epistles. And we know that from the letter to the Romans, because you remember how towards the end of Romans, there is a special greeting sent by one Tertius. "I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle." Now, when Paul writes to the Romans, he introduces himself as the Apostle Paul, called to be an apostle. And right throughout the epistle, reading through Romans, you would assume that Paul was sitting down and actually writing this epistle. And yet at the end we are being reminded it wasn't Paul who was actually handling the pen. Paul would be dictating, and Tertius would be the scribe or the writer of the epistle. And Tertius, the writer of Romans, the actual penman of Romans, he actually adds his own greeting to the greetings of the apostles and the others to the church at Rome. And there are those who are saying that Paul actually has not been writing the letter to the Galatians. He has been dictating it to some other individual. And then he is now beginning to write in his own hand these final verses. And there are quite a number of scholars who take that view. And that view, of course, on the face of it, seems to have quite a strong case to argue. And there are those, and it could be that that is in fact the case, and that Paul is writing with a large letter because he's not used to writing. One of the commentators says it might be the large or the untidy scrawl of someone who was not used to writing, or perhaps was used to writing more in Hebrew than in Greek. There are all kinds of views on the matter. But I don't think that that is really what Paul is emphasizing. I think what Paul is emphasizing is that he, in fact, has written this epistle. And that what he is saying is, "I have written unto you." The Apostle Paul seems to be saying, "I have actually written this epistle." Which may well have been an unusual thing for Paul to do. But in the circumstances, it perhaps would not be an unusual thing to do. And it may well be that Paul was not used to writing. And somebody who is not used to writing might be writing in a largely clumsy way. That is a possibility. And there are those who also say that Paul is writing these final words because of some eyesight problem. And we do know from chapter 4, for example, verses 13 If we go back to chapter 4, you remember at verse 13, Paul is reminding these Galatians of how it was that he first went to these towns, Lystra and Derbe and Iconium and so on, how it was that he went there to preach the gospel in the first place. And he reminds them, you know how through infirmity of the flesh, I preached the gospel unto you at the first. And my temptation, my problem, my trial, which was in my flesh, you despised not. You neither rejected me, but rather, he says, that you receive me as an angel of God, even as Jesus Christ. Where then is the blessedness you spoke of? Where is the attitude now that you had then? And Paul goes on in verse number 15 in chapter 4. For I bear you record, he says, that if it had been possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes, and you would have given them unto me. Now, you remember when we're looking at these verses, we made the point, it is quite possible that the Apostle Paul had some ophthalmic problem, and he couldn't see properly. It may well be associated with a thorn in the flesh. Some diseases cause disfigurement. And it may well be that the Apostle Paul was conscious of the fact that that the sickness of his eyes was making him somewhat repulsive in appearance. His bodily presence is weak. The thorn in the flesh. That is quite possible. And there are those who say that the Apostle Paul was not used to writing, but when he did write, in the same way as many people who don't have good eyesight, they write with large letters in order that they themselves can read what they have been writing. There are those who take that view. There are others who take the view that what Paul is doing is using the same kind of devices that we sometimes do when we want to underline something. Sometimes when you and I write, if we want to emphasize something, we put it in bold print. We write in capital letters, or we write in a different color of pen. We underline it. We put exclamation marks or asterisks beside it. Something to draw attention that what we are saying is important. And whatever you understand or remember about what I'm writing, don't forget this. This is important. And there are those who take the view that what Paul is doing in the closing verses of Galatians is underlining and simply going over again the important points that these Galatians must never forget. And as we're going to see, they must never forget the issues raised in the epistle and re-raised again in the closing verses of Galatians chapter 6. So what is the reason that Paul wrote with his large letters? I don't have the ultimate answer. I can give you an infallible answer to that question, and that is that nobody knows. Nobody knows for sure. And if it is that he had bad eyesight, if it is that he was writing to underline or simply writing not being used, we don't know. The point is that he is drawing attention to the fact that there is something here that really is worth considering. And if he has written this epistle from the very beginning, then surely it is an indication to these Galatians that Paul is taking a deeply personal interest in them. I'm writing this to you, and it is a great cost to me to write this to you. I am concerned over you, and you Galatians must know that I am writing to you because I am interested in your spiritual well-being, or something like that. But the issue is basically this. What is the gospel? Is it external or is it internal? Is it doing things or is it being something? Does it come from God? Does it come from God and man mixing in together? Or does it totally come from God? And man does nothing, nothing whatsoever, but simply respond in faith and in obedience to what God has done. So the first thing this morning is a comment on the large letter that Paul mentions here. And I don't know ultimately the answer, and I would suggest neither do you, but it's important that we do understanding some of these possibilities. So that's the first thing this morning that we emphasize. Then in verse 12, Paul comes to deal with some important issues. He emphasizes something to do with the cross of Christ. He says this, he is explaining to these Galatians why it is that false teaching arises in the church. Why is it that men come along after the Apostle Paul has been preaching to these Galatians that Christ crucified is the only way of salvation? Why is it that men come and say something different? And why is it that believers actually believe those who present something different? What is it that makes the human heart, even the Christian heart, so susceptible to false teaching? And Paul here is emphasizing it in verse 12. As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they constrain you to be circumcised. And why do they want you to be circumcised? Why do you even submit to circumcision is the implication. Or why is it that you submit to rules and regulations? That is the implication. Observing days and so on as a means to salvation. And the answer is only lest they should suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. Everything that men do in religion in some way or other either denies or demeans the cross of Christ. And Paul will have none of that. The gospel is central. It begins, it is built upon, it ends upon the cross of Christ. And the glory that is to come when saints are gathered together in the glory, our praise is going to be, we're told this in the book of Revelation chapter 5, our praise is going to be, worthy is the Lamb who was slain, because thou hast washed us from our sins in thy blood. The crucified Lamb, worthy is him who was slain. The cross of Christ is the praise of the saints in glory. And if you and I are going to be among that great multitude, in that everlasting world where everything is truly seen in its proper place, then we are going to have a view of the cross of Christ in this world, because the cross of Christ is the theme of the praises and the gratitude of the saints in the glory to come. Now notice what Paul is saying here. Only lest they should suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. Now Paul has already spoken in chapter 5 at verse 11 of the cross of Christ being an offense. He says, and I, brethren, this is going back to chapter 5, you remember. And I, brethren, if I now turn away from preaching the cross and turn to circumcision, why do I yet suffer persecution? Then is the offense of the cross ceased. You see, Paul is aware there is something that is inherently offensive in the cross of Christ, not only to the natural man, but to the remaining sin, even in the new man in Christ. There is something about the cross which seems to terrify us, confuse us, embarrass us. Because the cross is an instrument of death. And the Christian religion is not a religion of doing good and being a good neighbor. The religion of Christianity is being crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, we live, yet not I, but Christ who lives in me. And I'm emphasizing that because it needs to be emphasized. Sometimes people, even in the church, if you were to ask them, what is Christianity? Or what is a Christian? And they would probably tell you something like that. It's being a good person. It's being kind. Being a good neighbor. Going to church. And you get people in churches and they tell you that their Christian testimony is, well, we go to church every day. Our neighbors see us going to the church. Well, the neighbors may see us going to church, but that doesn't tell them anything about Christianity. It tells us something about ourselves. We go to church. But lots of people go to churches where Christianity is unknown. We might even say that the Muslims go to their church. Indeed, they probably go to their church more than we go to our church. So simply observing outward things is not in any way, as it were, revealing the true nature of Christianity, because it all is to do with the cross. And that's why I was reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and into chapter 2 in the opening verses there, because Paul, from verse number 17 in chapter 1, he's now beginning to get into the gospel, Because you see, in the church at Corinth, as we've been seeing in our studies on Wednesday evenings lately, the church at Corinth was in such a disarray that they were emphasizing other things. They were forgetting what Paul had been preaching among them. And Paul tells them in the opening verses of chapter 2 in 1 Corinthians, when I came among you to preach the gospel at Corinth, he says, I determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him having been crucified. There were many other things that Paul could have preached about. He could have preached about morality. He could have got stuck into these Galatians and preached about their immorality, for example. He could have preached about lots of things. But Paul knew that the only way to deliver men from sin and into salvation is to preach Christ crucified. And the only way to keep them in the faith is constantly to remind them of Christ crucified, in order that their faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. And in chapter 1 at verse 17, Paul reminds us, he reminds these Corinthians, Christ didn't send me to baptize. Now, he did send them to baptize because Paul was a minister of the gospel. And every minister is to be a baptizer in a sense. But that's not our function. That's an ancillary role. It's a secondary role. We're not professional baptizers, but we ought to be professional preachers. And what is the message that we're to be preaching? What is it that we're to be talking about? Paul says it is the cross of Christ. Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with the eloquence of men, lest the cross of Christ be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross, Paul says, is to those who are perishing, the preaching of the cross, which is the preaching of Christianity, that is foolishness. And you this morning can assess whether you are being saved or being lost by your attitude to the preaching of the crucifixion of Christ. And there are people who say, well, we know all about that. Let's get on to the heavy doctrine. There is no heavier doctrine. There is no lighter doctrine. There is no beginning more important than the cross of Christ. There is no ending more important than the cross of Christ. Because the crucified Christ is the Savior of the world, and that is the unique message of Christianity. The preaching of the cross is to those who are perishing. It's foolishness to them. And it is foolishness to those who are being saved. It is the power of God. And we have to ask the question, what is the offense of the cross? What is it about the cross that is so, so offensive that Paul speaks about it in verse 11 of chapter 5, as the offense of the cross ceasing, the moment that you turn from preaching Christ crucified and you begin to speak about Sabbath observance or belonging to certain denominations or certain ways of worship or certain ways of doing things, and the moment that you turn from the cross to these things, you are removing from Christianity and you are doing something that is easy and something that often is called in to do duty for the true understanding and working out of Christianity. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul explains to us why it is that the cross is such an offense and such foolishness to the natural man. He reminds us to the Jews, he says, it is a stumbling block. And to the Greeks, it is foolishness. Now, what does Paul mean when he itemizes the Jews and the Greeks? Well, the Jews were the religious people. They were the people who took religion very seriously. But their religion was not really centered upon a crucified Christ. It was centered upon the law. It was centered upon the observance of external things. It was the natural man's religion. If we do this, then God will be pleased with us and God will save us. And so the whole of the Jewish religion was not only something that was different to Christianity, it was something that was actually at enmity to Christianity. It was opposed to Christianity because it was emphasizing, yes, that God is merciful to sinners, but he is merciful to us on the basis of our faith, our obedience, our adherence to the law, or whatever it is you invent. That's the natural man's religion. And that is the way that the natural man tends to think. If I do good, I'll go to heaven. If you do good and leave it at that, that is the surest way for you to be lost. Because you going to heaven does not depend upon you doing good or doing anything. It depends upon something that God has done, what God has done for us in Christ. And so to the natural man's religion, where there is always the tendency, the habitual bent to do something to win God's favor. And then this apostle comes along and he preaches something that dismisses all man's efforts and all man's sincerity in a sense. He puts it all to the side. He bypasses it all. He bypasses their religion and says that religion has nothing to do with you having peace with God. Nothing whatsoever to do with it. Can you imagine how much of a stumbling block, an offense, an ugly, offensive message that would be? And it's the same today. That is why religious people are very often the most vocal and zealous opponents of evangelical Christianity. You look down through the history of the church, the great revivals, and you will find that whenever a revival has taken place in a church, you will find that the immediate response of antagonism is to unrevived Christianity or unrevived religion. It was the same with the apostles. It was the same with the great evangelical awakenings. It was the same at the time of the Reformation. It's the same always. It's the principle. The spiritually minded man, the moral man, the religious man, he finds the cross something that he doesn't understand. He can't see how it can be the fundamental way of going to God. We'll come back to that in a moment. But then also the Greeks. Paul says the preaching of the cross, he says, is foolishness, is a stumbling block to the Jews, the religious man, the religious mind. And then to the Greek, the rationalist, the man who is the philosopher, the scientist, the man who thinks that human reason is the way to go, and to live the good life is the best way to express human reason. And so to the Greeks, Paul says, this message of a crucified Redeemer, he says, that's just foolishness. The word that Paul uses is the word from which we get our English word moronic. When you think of a moron, you can hardly describe somebody in more despicable terms. If I say to you, or if you say to me, I'm a moron, you're a moron, that is something that we take very, very seriously. It's something that offends us. But that's the language that Paul uses. He says to the natural man who sees everything in terms of human reason and understanding, he says, the message of the crucified Jesus of Nazareth, he says, that is moronic. Now, why is it such an offense to the religious man? And why is it such foolishness to the reasonable man, the man who says our greatest gift is our human ability to think straight and solve mathematics reasonably and discover protons and subatomic particles and explore what can be explored because we have the mind. We can do it sort of thing. Why is it that Christianity interrupts and offends the whole spectrum of human religion and human reason? Because the crucified Christ tells us something about God. And it tells us something about man. It tells us that we're not good. It tells us that we're bad. It tells us that it doesn't matter how much religion we invent for ourselves, how many days we keep, how many observances we keep, how many religious rituals we invent, how many times we go to church. It doesn't matter in the ultimate sense, because we're unacceptable to God because we're born in sin and we're shaped in iniquity. The cross speaks not only of the depravity of man, and that if man is going to be saved, it's not by doing some good thing for God. It must be because God does something for us. But it also bypasses man. It shows us our helplessness, our hopelessness. And the fact of the matter is that nobody becomes a Christian until they come to an end of themselves. You will find that every Christian man, woman, boy or girl who has had a true spiritual awakening, they may not know all the implications or all the fine details of what has taken place, but there's one thing they know. We were preaching about it a few Sundays ago, or was it on the Monday of the communion, "One thing I know, once I was blind, but now I see." And what we see is the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. What we see is ourselves as polluted. No Christian believer argues for his own righteousness, because every Christian believer knows only too well the plague of his own heart. Nobody has to tell me how depraved I am and how wicked and devious. Nobody needs to tell me that. I tell it to myself day by day. The Apostle Paul told it to himself day by day. "In me, in my flesh," he says, "there dwells no good thing." If you were to say to Paul, "Paul, how do you compare with other Christians?" You know what Paul would say? He wouldn't say, "I'm more learned." He wouldn't say, "I know more of the scriptures," or "I pray better." He would say, "I am less than the least of all the saints." If you were to say to the Apostle Paul, "Where do you compare yourself among all the sinners of the earth?" Paul would say, "I'm the chief of sinners." There's no place in the heart of a Christian for pointing out the faults of other people. And the cross of Christ is not pointing out how sinful men are in a general kind of way. It is pointing out my total depravity. All my tears, if my eyes and my tears no respite know. All for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. And so the preaching of the cross of Christ is a demonstration or a declaration from God to this world. And he's saying to them, your religion can't save you. Whatever that religion be, it may masquerade as Christianity. It may have nothing to do with Christianity. But it is foolishness always to the rational mind and offensive to the moral religious mind. It bypasses man's reason. Paul goes on in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 to argue that the foolishness of God is wiser than men. Men think that they're so clever. We can send rockets to the planets now. Is that a great thing to do, we think? Isn't that great? Yes, it is, but it's not all that great. All you have to do is learn something, how to counteract gravity, get enough force, and off you go, and guide it with... And we know how it works. It's not all that great. It's good, but it's not all that great. It's within the possibilities of human reason, fallen enough as we are. But it can't save us. It can't bring us to God. We don't have the answers, because we don't even know what the basic questions are. We don't know that sin is a big problem for God. It's no problem for us. We take it for granted. It's the environment. It's our habitat. It's our habits in life. We get used to it. But God never gets used to it. Sin may not be a problem to you, and you may not see a big reason in being a sinner as to why you should be kept out of heaven, but God sees very many reasons. God is the great obstacle to your salvation. And unless you come through the crucified Christ, that obstacle will remain, because God is opposed to man's religion. And he's opposed to man's imagined wisdom. And the cross speaks not only of man's sin and man's depravity and hopeless helplessness. It speaks also of God's great love. Not because of what we are, but despite what we are, he loves us. And that's the astonishing thing about God's love. You and I, we tend to love the lovely. We tend to love those in whom we see something worth loving. And that's perfectly understandable. We're all doing that. But in us, there is no reason for God to love us. Nothing in ourselves, that is. There is a reason in him. But the reason for God's love for us as sinners is not found in us. It is found in God. And I don't know what that reason is, ultimately. Because God doesn't tell us why he loves us. He just says, "I do. I have loved you with an everlasting love. And with the bonds of loving kindness have I drawn you." That's all he says about it. We take it so much for granted, as though somehow or other it were our right that heaven should be opened unto us. And the cross says it's not like that. It's difficult to be saved. Salvation is not easy. It's not easy for God. It's not easy for us. And the moment that we try to live under the shadow of Calvary, we see how difficult it is to be a Christian. Because to be a Christian is to be crucified with Christ. Not just to be religious or to be wise, but to be crucified. And that for me is the difficulty of being a Christian, always crucifying self. And saying no, not to things. We can all say no to things. We can all give up things for Lent or give up things for... We can all sacrifice. But to say no to self, it's not denying ourselves things. It's denying ourselves ourselves. And the cross demands that. Because that's what it required of Christ. Not my will, but thy will be done. So when Paul says here, in verse 12, as many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they constrain you to be circumcised. Why do they constrain you to be circumcised? Because everything is easier than living under the cross. Everything is an easy option. Keeping days, observing rituals, that's dead easy. You don't have to be a Christian for that. But you must be a Christian. By grace alone and Christ in us alone to endure suffering persecution for the cross of Christ. And it's always the cross that brings the persecution. You stand up in a company of people and you tell them that you're a Protestant, a Westminster, you believe in the confession of faith, you go to a psalm singing church, you belong to a tradition that goes back and you can name it and you can give all the high points. Nobody will be offended at that. They might even admire you about that. But the moment that you take a stand in that same company for the implications of the cross, well, just do it. And you'll see what happens. Because you are saying to that company, you can't be saved unless you become as I am, as a crucified man with Christ, or a crucified woman. At that point, you'll see what happens. And that's why it is that these false teachers came along. And those Galatian new believers were willing to embrace it because already they had begun to discover that being a Christian was a difficult thing to be. Indeed, so difficult, it's impossible. By the grace of God, I am what I am. And that's what Paul is emphasizing once again. But the other thing that he emphasizes in verse number 13, and I must be more brief on this, where Paul really, as it were, gets into these false teachers. They constrain you, they compel you, that's the word that Paul used. They put constraints, they have a kind of force, an appeal to you. Be circumcised. That's the way to live as a Christian. Be a good person. That's the way. Go to church. Keep the days or whatever. That's the way to be a Christian. That's the way to avoid persecution. And then Paul's comment on them is in verse 13. For neither they themselves who are circumcised keep the law, but desire to have you circumcised that they may glory in your flesh. Paul says two things here. He says, these people who come along to you, and they tell you to be circumcised or to keep days, whatever the days be, whatever the laws are that they bring before you. You look at them, says Paul. You just look at them. Pause and look. And they don't even live up to their own standards. Those who insist on keeping the Sabbath day, do they keep the Sabbath day according to God? No, they don't. There's inconsistency. They don't even live up to their own standards, let alone living up to God's standards. What is the significance of circumcision? What did it mean for Abraham to be circumcised? It meant the cutting away of his flesh. It was a form of physical mutilation, painful and bloody, and symbolizing that out of him comes no good thing, and everyone whom he would have from his loins, so to speak, would be tainted, and they must be dealt with a cutting knife. Because without the shedding of blood, and circumcision was a bloodletting ritual, rather gory actually. In some countries it is illegal to circumcise little children or others as well. Because it is physical mutilation, and it was meant to be. It wasn't some little pretty thing that you did and thought no more about it. It was a demand to do what God tells you to do, whatever the cost. And you look at these people who are full of legalistic rules and want you to join their group. And just observe the inconsistencies of their own lives. They don't even live up to their own standards. And yet they will come and tell you how to live your life. Neither they themselves who are sick. They don't keep the law of God. They're so strong in the law. You're saved by keeping the law. You remember, we've seen what keeping the law means. It means loving your neighbor as yourself. It means sharing one another's burdens. This is what it means to fulfill the law of Christ. And often what you find is that people who are very strong for circumcision or other external observances, they're not the kindest people that you'll meet. They're not the most encouraging. They're not the most consistent. They're not the most helpful. Sometimes there's a rigid coldness about them, a frigidity. And Paul knew it well. He'd come across it. He'd grown up in that environment. He knew that to be a legalist did a terrible damage to the human soul. So not only does he point out the inconsistencies of those who come along and say, this is the way, compelling them to be circumcised. They even don't live up to it themselves. But also this, he says, they desire to have you circumcised that they may glory in your flesh. Look how many people we've circumcised. How many people have you got in your congregation? People ask you that. How many people do you have? How many people listen to your teaching? Not many, I must admit. Not many people in Sydney would even be remotely interested in what I'm saying this morning. We don't enter into the numbers game because we can't compete with the entertainers and the popular, the beautiful people and the attractive speakers. We can't compete. Paul didn't try to compete. But he knew that there was that mentality nonetheless that can enter into the church. And it was going to be a numbers game. How many belong to this group? How many belong to that group? And that's why I said in a previous sermon, you beware. You beware of pressure groups in any congregation where there is the siphoning of, you come and join us, we'll show you a better way. You beware of these dangerous people because they will lead you away from the gospel. They will lead you away into being a party man with certain convictions to be true, to be sure. But they will not be the convictions of a crucified Christ. And we're going to say more about that when we come to verse 14. And so what Paul is saying as he is coming to the conclusion of this epistle, he's not winding it down, he's winding it up. And can you get anything greater than this in the last two verses, where we'll come to in a week or two? Where he says to these Galatians, from henceforth let no man trouble. You Galatians, don't you trouble me anymore, he says about these issues. I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. That's winding it up. And then the final, brethren, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit. That's winding it up. The one thing I want for you Galatians, he says, is that you should know the grace of Christ. So these closing verses are by no means a kind of tailing off. They're a winding up, and Paul ends on a grand note. Large letters, making a desire in the flesh so that you'll evade the implications of the cross. And even those who make these grand claims, you must be circumcised, or you must do this, or you must do that, or you must do, even they don't do what they're saying you must do. And so Paul is saying to them, what is your Christianity? Is it merely externalism? Or is it knowing Christ? Is it relying upon what you are and can do? Or is it relying upon what God is and what he can do and has done? Which is it to be? Because it is one or the other. And the Apostle Paul has been arguing throughout this epistle, salvation is not the work of man. It is solely the work of God. And the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, as he tells in chapter 3, and on this I'm going to finish, on chapter 3, the preaching of the cross. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, God's curse upon us, because it was placed upon him. He endured the curse. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. And are we going to exchange that precious truth of Christ taking away our curse by taking it to himself and start engaging in some religious ritualism and listening to people who would be no help but a hindrance to us? Which is it going to be for us today? And that's why Paul is closing as he does, challenging them. Some of these Galatians no doubt would listen, and some would not. But whether men listen or not is not the point. We preach Christ crucified, not with the wisdom of men, because we don't want your faith to be based upon man's wisdom or man's eloquence, the eloquence of a preacher. We want you to have faith that is based solely not on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. And where that faith through God's power exists, then that's the true faith. And that faith can respond to apostolic injunctions and warnings and entreaties. But it's the only thing that will. May God bless his word to us.